Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Sediment Podcast, where we cover the annual meeting of the American Society of Pediatric Nephrology and bring you eminent panelists, thoughtful discussions, and a distilled version of events that went on in DC. The conference this year ended on May 1st, and we are recording episode 2 of the Sediment for 2023 on May 7th. I'm your host, Sudha Garimella. I'm a pediatric nephrologist in sunny Greenville, South Carolina. I ask all our panelists to introduce themselves and give us their book recommendations or some pearls or fun facts about themselves. So I guess I will start. My fun fact is that I have been forced by my parents to learn 3 different types of Indian classical dance, Odissi, Kathak, and Kuchipudi, but I have 2 left feet. So now, my husband, who is very good at salsa dancing, has made a dancer out of me. And his trick is he just keeps me laughing. So as long as he has a bunch of jokes and I'm laughing and not thinking about the steps, I can dance. So that's my fun fact. I'm going to introduce our panelists today. We're going to start with Laura Vallawander. Dr. Vallawander, take it away.
Hi, thanks for having me. So I'm Laura. I'm a second year pediatric nephrology fellow at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus. My fun fact is that I really have started to enjoy gardening, like landscape gardening. I think that's because I have 2 kids. And so it's one of the only activities my husband and I have found we can successfully do and keep our children alive at the same time. And we have started to enjoy it. And then this summer is starting to get underway. So we're really looking forward to getting outside and doing that. In terms of a book recommendation, I don't have much time to read for pleasure anymore. When I do, I really enjoy James Patterson. But most of the reading I do is with my kids. And we have recently discovered the Bob books, which are like early reader books. And they're amazing. They're sold in like small box sets to work through like different levels of reading skills. But my kiddo is 4.5 and like he can read the like initial beginning books of this series. So it's been wonderful.
Oh, that sounds like a great recommendation, Bob. So that's it. The series is called Bob.
B-O-B. Yeah, Bob. Yeah, B.O.B. Bob books. Wonderful. We bought ours at like Costco in a huge box set. But I've seen them in like smaller box sets at other places too.
Wonderful. Well, yeah. Thanks for that recommendation. And well, planting season is starting, so we'll get busy, all the gardeners, right? Excellent. All right. Next, we have Dr. Ellen Cody. Ellen?
So my name is Ellen Cody, and I'm a faculty at Washington University in St. Louis or St. Louis Children's.
And we're waiting for your fun fact.
Oh, yeah. So I guess my fun fact is, in terms of books, I think ones that I enjoy and I feel like some kids would enjoy as well are actually the Percy Jackson book series. I don't know if you guys have heard of them.
Yes.
They're fabulous. And they, so there's like the initial series that covers Percy Jackson, but then he kind of has like a whole universe of books as well. So I think, Laura, even for your kids, even when they're 4 and as he gets older, you can read to him and then he can start reading to you and things. So I always recommend them to everyone who has kids and they enjoy reading with their kids. I read them just myself. I have
me too. Me too.
Yeah, they're
I read them for fun, and it taught a lot about Greek mythology and Roman mythology to the kids. So you know, plus.
There's
excellent
a Norse
recommendation.
Egyptian mythology series. They're fabulous. Excellent books.
Wow. Yeah, I'll have to check them out. I haven't heard of those. That sounds great.
I think, Laura, your kids have to be just a tad older to get into that.
Okay. Well. That means I have some time to find them and explore them, right?
Finish the Bob series first and then move on to Percy Jackson.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us. So we are going to jump right into it with our episode today, which is titled Advances in Therapeutics. And you were actually chairing a session which was looking at lupus nephritis. It was a fantastic session. We had a great turnout. I think the room was filled. So we're just going to do a quick recap. So first, I want to ask you, Ellen, your impression about the whole session. How did it go? What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, as you said, I think the session, even when I kind of heard just the list of topics, I thought was going to be really interesting. And I thought the speakers did a really fabulous job of One, they didn't overlap at all, which I think is great. They kind of dovetailed each other really, really nicely, talking about things that I think are really relevant and coming into the forefront for lupus nephritis therapy. In terms of, it's been an exciting kind of past couple of months and years with lupus, and that we actually have some new drugs. And then I think we're also starting to hopefully make some progress in actually treating lupus and improving outcomes, and then hopefully changing the way that we treat lupus. So I think it was a really fascinating session, and people came with questions, and the speakers did a really fantastic job in discussing what the changes and advances are with the therapeutics. So I thought it was a really great session.
Yes, yes. And so, of course, you know, we started off with that old workhorse of nephrologists, which I think the present generation of pediatric nephrologists honestly have not, thankfully, had to use a whole lot of Cytoxan. And, you know, Scott Wendorfer led us through the question really was, do we still need Cytoxan? And what are the indications? When is it an appropriate therapy? And what can it do? And what are the pitfalls, right? That was the whole talk.
Yeah, so I thought he did a really nice job of outlining kind of what are the indications to still use it. And I think in lupus, that really is the question, because with the new therapeutics that we have, and even with the new research that's coming out with MMF, is do we still need it for lupus? Even the more severe disease category, is there still an indication for it? And I think it's showing, he had some great slides showing that the perception among pediatric nephrologists is changing, that maybe we don't need it. I think he had a slide or two that showed, you know, even as many as 5-10 years ago, the majority were still picking Cytoxan, but now I think the majority are starting to choose MMF for the more severe cases. And so I think it's just showing that the more studies that we do and things are showing that the outcomes are really the same. And with the side effects of Cytoxan, I think the paradigm is shifting to pick MMF. And I think the outcomes aren't changing. And I think with all the new therapeutics, I think the talk was interesting with not just his, but with the other ones on the idea of triple therapy. And I think that was kind of one of the that were brought up, not just in his talk, but with the others. And is that the direction that it's going? And what is that going to mean for patients?
That's right. To just, you know, not just target one area for therapeutics, but kind of simultaneously looking at it from different parts of the immune system and targeting those, which I thought was fantastic. I see that we have Dr. Jerome Lane. He's still coming on. So while he is joining us, we will just continue to talk about Scott's talk, which was about, I think he covered urolupus. Do you have any thoughts about that, Ellen?
Yes. So, you know, I personally myself, when I do use Cytoxan for lupus, have shifted from using the NIH regimen to the urolupus regimen, just because the data on that has shown that, again, the effectiveness is equivalent and the side effects are less. And knowing how really toxic Cytoxan can be, that personally is my preference. And again, I think he did a great job really of outlining the studies that we have. And I think also he pointed out most of the data that we have is adult data. And that was kind of, again, a theme throughout the session. But, you know, again, that if we have to use Cytoxan, I think the thing that he kind of pointed out was like, maybe we should talk about MMF first. But if you think that you need Cytoxan, well, then maybe think about the lower dose regimen first. Or if they failed MMF, well, then maybe do the urolupus regimen first. And then if they failed that, well, then maybe you escalate this. So I think he just kind of outlined your options really, really nicely for patients that are having a really recalcitrant course.
Right. So it's not like a fixed dose throw everything at the problem with Cytoxan. Even Cytoxan we can use with more thoughtfulness and, you know, try to minimize side effects. I think that was a great point. We're going to take a small break to welcome Dr. Jerome Lane, who's just joined us. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry to join the podcast late.
Hey, listen, it's Sunday night. I'm just glad that you guys are all here. Thank you so much.
We have a beautiful day in Chicago, and I was walking the dog, and time got away from me. So hopefully your listeners will forgive me.
Well, so we just barely got started chatting about the lupus nephritis session, but we're going to take a little pause so you can tell us a little bit about yourself and a fun fact about yourself.
Ah, okay. Well, I'm Jerome Lane, and I am a pediatric nephrologist at Lurie Children's Hospital in Northwestern in Chicago. I have a keen interest in lupus, which is, I'm a general nephrologist, but I also do our rheumatology clinic here at Lurie, and have been interested in lupus for many, many years. Fun fact, I don't know what you consider fun. I'm also
We're nephrologists. Everything is fun.
Well, I'm interested in creative writing as well. I have a degree in writing, and I'm pursuing that as well as sort of a alternate vocation. So
do you publish under a pseudonym or?
No. I'd like to publish, period. But no, short stories and stuff like that. Still working on that.
So that's wonderful. That is great. So this is my third year being editor for this podcast, and I've had the privilege of talking to so many pediatric nephrologists, and it just blows my mind how many almost second careers we can have. I would have thought that, the training we go through and everything, that people leave their hobbies and passions by the wayside. But I think nephrologists are proving that we can certainly keep those alive. And probably, would you agree with me that that is a great antidote for burnout?
Well, for sure. I think a lot of physicians in general are frustrated artists. There's a lot of physician writers, musicians. And I think having an outside interest makes you a better doctor and makes you a better artist. So, I think they complement each other.
Yes, I can write poetry and fiction, but when it comes to a grand proposal, gone. I can't do anything. But anyway, that's so wonderful. Thanks for joining us. So we just got started talking with Ellen about the session that you were chairing. Mm-hmm. Both of you together. It was an excellent session. I want to reiterate that I learned so much, because so much has changed in the world of lupus in the past decade that I think it is well, it was a timely session and it talked about a lot of possibilities. Right, Laura, do you agree?
Yeah, I'm actually hearing you guys summarize the first talk. Very sad that I missed that talk. I the other portions I was there for, but I wasn't able to be at the very first lecture. And I'm thinking about the fact that we've had a ton of lupus nephritis, it feels like, in the past, 2 years I've been a fellow, and pretty severe cases. I can, probably count on at least 5 kids that have just had dialysis dependent renal failure, on presentation, and they've all got Cytoxan. And it seems to me, anecdotally, it feels like our rheumatologists are always trying to push us towards the Euro lupus protocol. And it feels like we're always pushing towards the NIH protocol, and really we're always pushing for Cytoxan. And so hearing your guys' summary of the discussion, I guess it's making me wonder if I need to kind of be questioning our therapeutic approach, or when you're at the point that you're dialysis dependent on presentation, that's enough that Cytoxan is for sure indicated.
I was going to say, Dr. Windefer, again, had a nice slide to talk about the differences with a low GFR, so less than 30, that it probably doesn't matter. Again, this is mostly in adult data, as we've kind of been talking about, but that picking a therapeutic, even when they're that severe, that the outcomes are probably not necessarily going to be better between Cytoxan and MF.
And I find that interesting, because those are the patients for which we tend to use Cytoxan, right? We say, oh, they're really severe, we better give them Cytoxan. They're on dialysis, the evidence doesn't bear that out. Currently.
Does not support it. I was talking to Scott after his talk to be like, do you think there's maybe a little bit of a selection bias in those patients? And maybe that's why we see that those patients do poorly, because we're like, oh, these are the patients with severe disease, so we choose to give them Cytoxan. And I think that's maybe what historically nephrologists do. And so maybe that's why we continue to give them Cytoxan. So I do wonder, with some paradigm shift, if we're going to see some of the data change or some of that, because I think that's, so maybe what you're seeing, Laura, at your institution is some of the data doesn't support it, because in the really severe patients, we select them out to give Cytoxan. And I know that's, I think whenever I've talked to some of the more experienced nephrologists, that's been their perception.
We've known for a long, long time now about the equivalence for non-inferiority anyway, in most trials for mycophenolate and the cyclophosphamide. So when I see the data that especially Scott put up for the conference, it surprises me that as many people are using Cytoxan as
right.
The 30-40%, I think. And, it's interesting that I don't know why anyone uses Cytoxan anymore. I think there's, like you said, Ellen, I think there's a bias because it's IV. We think, well, it's more powerful, but, or maybe it works faster, but there's really just no evidence for that.
If I can jump in, I don't know if the data is sometimes we do have someone that we try MMF and they fail it, so to speak, and then we switch to Cytoxan. if they're all bundled together as Cytoxan patients, maybe that's why there is a higher number showing up there.
It's hard to know, and it's hard to know how it applies in pediatrics as well. And pediatrics in general is more severe nephritis than adults. But I think we have better rescue drugs these days than cyclophosphamide. So in generally, yes. You know, when I have a kid who's failing cyclophosphamide, I'm failing mycophenolate, and this kind of leads into the other talks. I'll think about belimumab or voclosporin or calcineurin inhibitor. So it's very rare these days that I use cyclophosphamide.
To Laura's point, like if the kidneys are failing, if they're progressing rapidly towards dialysis, I do feel like the bias continues to be to make sure they've gotten Cytoxan. And I don't know, despite all the data, and I don't know if that's just because it's continued bias, given that's what we always did. And
I was going to say, you know, I think we've been worried we don't have pediatric data for the long-term outcomes. And if I don't give them Cytoxan, you know, what am I setting them up for in the future? I don't know if there was discussion about what kind of pediatric trials we think might be on the horizon for these other options for therapy.
I think we have enough, at least anecdotal and observational studies at this point, to suggest that we're not really shortchanging lupus patients if we don't give them cyclophosphamide. I don't feel bad about not giving. Now, my bias again has been, you know, a kid comes in on needing dialysis, I often give them cyclophosphamide, but what I'll do is usually give them an abbreviated course. So we might only do it for 2 or 3 months and then switch over to mycophenolate. And one last point is that I am a big believer in the Eurolupus protocol. And if I am giving cyclophosphamide, I usually do it by the Eurolupus protocol.
I mentioned that earlier, that for lupus, I use the NIH dosing, I use Eurolupus as well.
Yeah, for sure. I think on the other hand, though, I'm not sure why people use cyclophosphamide for lupus, but I, you know, as an old timer here, been in the game for a while, I feel like we've scared a whole generation off of cyclophosphamide. I mean, we used to use it quite a bit in minimal change nephrotic syndrome very successfully. And I still think it's a good drug. I barely use it anymore because I think we have alternatives these days, but I think it can be a good drug and we do see sustained remission. So I feel like a whole generation has sort of been dissuaded from cyclophosphamide as an option in many renal diseases where I think if you have experience with it, it's really not such a scary drug. But that being said, I rarely do use it for lupus.
Right. And I think that, you know, for our listeners in Europe and Asia, I think this may be a uniquely American phenomenon too, because there is still quite a prevalent use of Cytoxan even for the, you know, nephrotic syndrome patients in other parts of the world. From the literature, it appears that they're using it more often than we do here. So you're right about the fear of Cytoxan. When I was training as a fellow, I still remember we would do everything to, you know, not use Cytoxan, give ourselves reasons why we don't want to use it. And when the non-inferiority trial came out, I think everybody just switched to MMF and we didn't look back. But I think with Dr. Wenderfer's talk, what I realized is there are certain situations where it should be applied. It should be applied in a stepwise fashion. We were talking about that, and the Eurolupus protocol, I think, has really shown us that, you know, we can do this in a mindful fashion. Talking to young adults now who received Cytoxan as teenagers, you know, they have a lot of complaints about it, which, you know, I mean, I don't want to get into that in this hour, but we do have to be mindful about long-term effects on sterility and things like that, and get better as a, you know, group of people using this medicine about their future fertility and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do discuss fertility preservation with any of our patients mm-hmm. who are getting cyclophosphamide.
Right. And so that, you know, is that more uniform use of all of those techniques. And I think that would help. I think it is a tool in our toolbox, right? That's what I took away from it, that it's a tool in our toolbox. But then we have other more exciting things. And Ankana Daga talked us through CNIs and voclosporin. Have you used it?
I have for several patients. I've been disappointed so far, but I think that the several patients I've used were very late in their disease and far advanced disease and may not respond to anything at this point, haven't been responding. So I'm still cautiously optimistic. I think it's the most exciting thing that's happened in recent times, apart from belimumab for lupus. And I'm very eager to continue to use it. I'm interested to see how it might be used outside of lupus, because I think it could be an interesting alternative for minimal change disease, or maybe even FSGS. But it's a calcineurin inhibitor, to let our viewers know that has better absorption, better pharmacokinetics. You don't need to monitor levels. Seems to have fewer side effects and nephrotoxicity. So why not? But so I've only used it for a handful of patients so far, and I think I haven't seen the long-term benefits of it yet.
So I used it in one teenage patient last year, and he stopped taking it because, honestly, he said that the smell
I've heard that.
His girlfriend off.
So, I've heard that. I have heard that.
Yes, I think it has got a very strong odor. So that's another thing that our teenage patients are very, you know, reluctant to use. That was the reason he just would not take it anymore. But that was my N of one, and it didn't work.
I guess just the reintroduction of using CNIs in general, not necessarily in induction therapy, because I think we're a little hesitant because of the nephrotoxicity, but even just for me, therapy as like another tool. I feel like it's maybe a little bit more common in Asia, based on that's where all the studies come from. But, you know, it's never really a drug that I think of that commonly, unless I'm getting really desperate. But I think it's, the studies show that it's quite effective. And then I think she raised some good points on one, induction, but then two, the idea of a triple immunosuppression using a CNI, whether it's going to be voclosporin or even just tapro. And I think it raised some really interesting questions and potential for the future. That I think that all made a lot of sense, I think, in the setting of the pathophys for lupus, not just from the inflammation, but the podocyte and those sorts of things. So I think, you know, I think she kind of closed out her talk, or even I think it was during the Q&A session. It wasn't ready for like a prime time induction, but it definitely was like a, you know, another, I guess, tool in your toolbox and, you know, things to think about, or if a patient was not responding, and then something that we could definitely think more about. So I think it's just kind of a theme that I kind of pulled from the whole session, was that we have a lot more options, I think, than we realize, and kind of rethinking CNIs and their effectiveness that I just never really thought of. You know, I think we're so used to the cyclophosphamide MMF debates with steroids that it was like rethinking the CNIs was a really interesting. I thought her talk was fascinating, and the data was a lot richer than I expected.
Yeah, I think you make some good points, Ellen. I think apart from the from voclosporin, I think just calcineurin inhibitors in general, you know, 5 years ago or so, they weren't much on my radar for lupus, but now I'm much more willing to use even just tacrolimus for patients who are just not really doing well on mycophenolate, or even adding it with some good results in some cases. So, and the data is much richer in that regard.
I think even, you know, we think about other diseases that are causing podocyte damage, you know, and I think even when we're getting into the maintenance phase of lupus, that they could just have some ongoing podocyte effacement, or, you know, podocyte damage NOS. And I think we don't really know what's going on with lupus. And so I think CNIs could be a great option, whether it's going to be voclosporin. You know, she mentioned the pill burden that comes along with voclosporin, which is, I think, going to be a real challenge. And then now I didn't even know about the odor.
Yeah, I've had some complaints from patients as well. So.
So I think it's that class in general, I think, could, you know, have some real possibility for those patients that have that persistent, not necessarily nephrotic, but high degree of proteinuria that we just kind of can't capture, or that, you know, maybe medium level inflammation that we just cannot control with steroids, or we're trying to do some more steroid sparing. I think interesting and kind of a different perspective than the B cell and kind of the other NKF beta, that sort of thing. So I think it's just a different pathway that we can tackle.
True, Ellen. So you were talking about triple therapy earlier. So I wonder if the CNIs have a space in that, like, you know, as not adjunct, but sort of more combination therapy. Is that what I'm hearing from what you're saying?
Myself, yes. I think one of the things that came not just from her talk, but like the belimumab and the rituximab talk as well, is the idea of a triple therapy. You know, I think we're very comfortable and used to prednisone plus something else. But I think now the idea with some of these new drugs is going to be the idea of triple therapy, meaning prednisone plus potentially MMF plus a CNI or belimumab or something else. We have the preliminary data, but we don't have the long-term effects, you know, so we don't know what the long-term effects are going to be of being that immunosuppressed with lupus, which already has the immune dysregulation. So I think potentially could be quite effective for treating the disease, but what is it going to mean long-term? So I think that it was an interesting idea, but we don't know what the long-term things are going to be. So I think no one's kind of jumping to start it right now, but I think it's a potential for therapeutic down the line.
Right. And so one of those tools could be the MABs, and Daryl Okamura walked us through Belimumab. I can no longer pronounce any of these MABs, but Beli, we'll just call it Beli. It's two things that stood out for me from his talk were that it seems like an effective adjunct therapy, not definitely not a monotherapy. And it's not for those kids who have heavy proteinuria. So that was my big takeaway. But what are the clinical pearls do you have? Or when would you use Belimumab? What sort of patients would meet that criteria? And either one of you can go first.
Yeah, again, I tend to use it as part of rescue therapy in patients who are not doing as well. It's interesting, the data on not being used for heavy proteinuria. I've tended to use it in patients who have had persistent kind of nephrotic syndrome. But I think, again, I've not seen impressive results with it. Again, I think it's been useful as adjunctive therapy, but we're doing so many other things at the same time, intensifying steroids and maybe increasing the MMF dose or adding rituximab at some point. So hard to know from my anecdotal experience, but I tend to use it as rescue therapy and sort of adjunctive therapy. But the interesting thing, that the points that some of the studies he showed suggested that it's better or works well as part of induction therapy, which I found interesting. But then when we asked him afterwards, he said, well, he doesn't use it that way. He uses it like I just said, as rescue therapy. So maybe there's a role for it in the initial induction period. So
it'd be interesting to figure out which patients should get it then as part of that induction therapy.
And along those lines, I think that's what we don't know. And then also we wouldn't know, that's kind of the question with the triple therapy, right? Because we wouldn't use it as a single agent with induction therapy. So then we'd still have the steroids plus, I guess, technically the MMF, but then we'd add the belimumab. But then what is that going to do long term, right? And we have no idea. That was kind of the question. And I think, none of the panelists know, and we don't know. One, and I think the other question that they were also asking, and I think the kind of their dream study would be starting belimumab at like 3 months post-diagnosis. You know, we kind of start to see how they do after 3 months of MMF, and if they aren't having the response that we want, then we add the belimumab. Jerry, would you agree that that was kind of what they ideally would want to do? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So what about good old rituximab? Most of us have lots of experience using Ritux. So I couldn't, like in my head, I couldn't say, why would I use rather than Ritux? Is that not a fair question?
I think it's a fair question. You know, I think I think it was Dr. Daga who talked about rituximab, or was it Dr. Goylov? Now I'm getting, no, because Dr. Daga did the CNI. So it's Dr. Goylov. She talked about the other ones, right?
Yes, she talked about bortezomib and obinutuzumab and all the other ones. Yes.
So yeah, all the MABs. I think her point was that with our issues defining remission in lupus, was rituximab truly a failure? And I think a lot of people would disagree that it was not, and that rituximab can be quite effective to treat lupus. And so I think similarly, it might come down to a preference. And some people, and I know some rheumatologists, especially with a more severe disease, will push to give rituximab right off the bat for initial induction, which I've seen used for initial induction with patients, one with CNS, and then two with severe class 4 lupus nephritis.
Our rheumatologists often do that, yeah.
Right. So I don't know if eventually belimumab will also be that way. Like, obviously, there's no non-inferiority there. But so I don't know if, to your point, it's going to be a one or the other, or if that's just where we're at right now. I have absolutely no idea.
The data seems better for belimumab, actually. The famous LUNAR trial was quite disappointing with rituximab. Everyone expected good results, and in the subset of analysis, there may be some benefit, but but people continue to use it because of anecdotal experience and also subsequent kind of observational studies that suggested that it is useful, and we do use it as both in initiation for bad lupus patients in general, and very often in adjunct therapy. But I wouldn't use it alone to rescue a patient. It just doesn't seem to be enough on its own.
And the interesting thing about the belimumab trial was, that they had to change the endpoints because they weren't seeing a response to kind of all of those things, the other issues with that, with their endpoints as well. So, you have to wonder if they had changed endpoints with Rotux trial, would they have detected any response?
Yeah.
Right. So it looks like we have a lot of new tools. And so I think that's a good segue to Dr. Goyalov's talk. We're moving beyond rituximab and looking at all of these other mAbs. So she talked about CAR T cell therapy and, you know, all this fans. I feel like people are just like dragging us nephrologists into the 21st century with all these therapies, whereas 40% are still stuck with Cytoxan.
Yeah, it's all very exciting. I think, yeah, the CAR T therapy is really kind of fascinating. I think there have been selected cases of lupus patients getting stem cell transplant.
I think one
for really
patient
bad disease,
that was described, yeah.
Promising results, but this seems to be a less toxic way of doing that. Yeah, I think that's the future. I don't think we're there yet, certainly not in pediatrics, but I think there's so many of the new mAb drugs that it's really hard to know what to make of them or what usefulness they'll have.
Yes. I think the point was made during the Q&A that like lupus is still being treated like breast cancer in the 1950s, that we are not remotely close to first-line medicine for lupus. Despite how heterogeneous the disease is. So, you know, especially with all the new mAbs and things, you'd think that at some point we could, you know, tailor our therapies a little bit better. And so maybe that's where eventually we would get is tailoring our therapies. And so maybe we would identify patients that would respond to belimumab versus rituximab versus other mAb versus CAR T, whatever drug they're going to come up with next. I don't know.
I think we're moving toward the age of individualized medicine. In fact, there's a trial now going on on the rheumatology side, well, there are nephrologists involved as well, looking at individual pharmacokinetics for mycophenolate and treating lupus nephritis.
The PLUM study?
Yeah, yeah. And so I think what Dr. Goyalov said is really just the logical extension of that is, you know, sort of immunotyping patients with lupus and, you know, maybe picking your different tools out of the toolbox for different immunological profiles.
And just use one drug to cover one aspect of B-cell immunity so that we are not only attacking from one angle, but three different ways. Mm-hmm. So again, I thought that made a lot of sense. However, I think because we are talking about lupus nephritis and prolonging the life of kidneys, it was just funny that she had that quote, the fate of the kidney in the Bible. I'm a history buff, so for me, that was fun. For our viewers or our listeners who, no viewers here, just listeners. For our listeners, she had a slide where she said that the kidneys live to 120 years. And so we are failing our kidneys because we don't live long enough. Our kidneys can go on beyond us. So I thought that was a fantastic way of framing, you know, the lifespan of kidneys. And hopefully with all these new therapies, we will get to where patients who are living with lupus nephritis can hope for a full kidney lifespan with these amazing therapies. I think that we had a very productive session. This was an excellent recap. I want to just go around the table for last thoughts about this session before we switch to the other part of our podcast, which was about the session on CKD. So any last words of wisdom to practicing nephrologists taking care of patients with lupus nephritis?
No, I think, it's just an exciting time in lupus. I think, you know, we still need a lot of information in terms of how to use these drugs, even in the adult world. So it's going to take time to sort this out in the pediatric world, just starting to use some of these drugs, belimumab and voclosporin and even calcineurin inhibitors coming back into our vocabulary for lupus. So I think it's exciting that we have more options. I think with more options comes more confusion in a way. And more responsibility, you know, to kind of keep abreast of these things and figure out how to use them safely.
Yes. And our patients are looking to us for making their lives better. So we feel the weight of that, especially taking care of children living with lupus. Ellen, any last thoughts about this session?
I think just kind of showing how we learn old medicines for even kind of older diseases and continuing spreading the knowledge and the learning, I think, both between pediatric nephrologists and then also with the adult nephrologists. I think kind of debating if pediatric and adult lupus are the same or different, particularly as we're trying to get these drugs approved with the pediatric patients. But I thought it was a really great session. I was really happy to be a part of it.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so we should thank our speakers, Scott Wunderfer, Beatrice Goyalov, Frank Daga, and Carol Okamura for excellent talks.
Yeah, it's really great.
Yes, I think it was a very productive session for all practicing nephrologists and fellows in training. So thank you both of you for joining us to discuss the lupus nephritis session. So that's a good segue for us to talk about the other session where we talked about new therapeutics. So that was the pediatric chronic kidney disease session. And we had some excellent talks, and we're going to just recap in a few minutes some of the, you know, new things that we learned are on the horizon for CKD. So the first thing, of course, we should mention is the U25 calculator, which is available on QXMD. It's a great little tool. I have switched to using it. What are you doing, Laura? How do you do your estimated GFR in clinic?
You know, that's how I tend to calculate it, is on the U25. I think you start approaching kids, or not even kids, right? Like young adults. And I start questioning, gosh, should I be using the U25? Should I be using like the KF?
Oh, yes.
For the like young adults, right? Yeah. Like, should I using CKID, or should I be switching to NKF? And like, what age point do I make that change? Because sometimes you get like markedly different GFRs, right? Where you're like, oh, this is actually normal if I'm on NKF. And then I think if I don't have the time, that's when I still default to using like the bedside Schwartz, right? Like, you know that off the top of your head. I can plug it in the calculator on my phone, and like I have an EGFR when I'm standing in the PICU, right? And I don't have to try to pull up the website. And
so. And I think a lot of our EMRs are still defaulting to modified Schwartz. So if in the EMRs, that's what our residents are looking at. What I liked about the U25 is, even if you don't get a cystatin C, you can still calculate a EGFR using creatinine alone. And what we got from that session is that, you know, there's less bias. So this should be our go-to calculator for EGFR, is what I understood from this session. And of course, needless to say, there's no race coefficient, and there's no possibility of bias like that. So I felt more reassured that we were using the right estimated calculator for that. GFR. Okay. All right. GFR too. We really want every single point of the GFR, don't we?
All right. Yeah, and I agree. So, it made me feel like I need to be pulling that up every time. And
it's a little app, the QXMD. I downloaded it when that study came out, and they were, you know, spreading the word about it. And I've been using it probably for almost a year. And I thought that's great. It's kind of easy to use, definitely.
I say that's a pro tip, because I think I still go to the like CKID website. So I'll have to get the app.
Okay. So me telling a fellow that, you know, that I live on my phone is sort of sad, but I live on my phone, so I want everything on my phone. Right. And, you know, we should routinely be using cystatin C for CKD staging, was the other thing I got there. And I think that a lot of us have switched our practices in the recent past and are getting cystatin C more reliably for our patients with CKD, at least. So I think that was good in terms of diagnostics, to like spread the word about using the U25 calculator, because it's got less bias. And then, of course, I don't know if you caught the William Schnapel lecture this year. It's a wonderful endowed lecture. And we had a great speaker, Kevin Lemley, who literally dragged us kicking and screaming into the 21st century with this fantastic talk about machine learning and artificial intelligence.
That talk made me want a more computer programming background, right? Like, I wish I knew more about that and understood that.
Yes, and I'll be honest. 95% of the techniques he was talking about went over my head. But then I sat up when he said, if you do digital biopsies and you can estimate long-term EGFR, I was like, you can what? And then I sort of, you know, paid more attention. But it was a fantastic talk. And I mean, I'm so grateful that we have these endowed lectures as part of ASPN, so we can get these speakers, like I said, just, you know, giving us a overview of what could be done with the help of technology. So
yeah, that talk made me feel like, right, that's the way of the future. Like, things like this are going to be built into the EMR for multiple types of problems or predictors. And that's what we need. And that's what's going to make us better doctors.
Right. We're going to imagine a world where our patient checks in at their kiosk in the waiting room, gives a drop of blood. We have a genetic profile. We can tell them what their risks are, what kind of diseases they have, and what would be the best therapeutics for them based on that, right? So it's like
maybe they won't need us then, right?
Yes. But that was a brilliant lecture and he was amazing. He was such so good with walking us through all of that. And then, of course, Laura Hessman talked to us about SGLT2 inhibitors and CKD. Obviously, the adult nephrology world is like in love with Flozins, right? Everyone's a Flozinator. Mm-hmm. But this made me a little sad because I really, didn't see that we have any pediatric data.
No, it makes me want this, right? For my patients, like they're... Studies yes. looked like they were so strong and so convincing that I don't know why you wouldn't have all right. of your
the DAPA CKD trial results were reviewed and absolutely great protection that it offers in our adult patients was reviewed, but we haven't quite made that connection yet to pediatric data. But there is biological plausibility, so yes, it can be used safely in all children except type 1 diabetes. We just need to prove it and get the data going. So all of our researchers, this is the call to action, right?
Yeah, that I think you'd have a lot of people like ready to enroll patients in that type of study, right?
Yes. And also like our young adults, they're 18 and above and they're still in our practices. We need to start thinking about, well, what therapeutics are available to them now that are FDA approved for adults that we can start using for our older teenagers? Because, transition is a process. Not everybody is transitioned out of our clinics at age 18. We still take care of 19-year-olds, sometimes 20, sometimes 21. So that population, I think we should be really, putting our hats on like our adult call, think like our adult colleagues and do what's right for them, right? So that's what I got out of that. And then of course, Elaine Ku talked about sparsentan. I don't know what you thought about that. She talked about its, the studies for IgA and FSGS and the role that these drugs can have in taking care of patients with CKD. She discussed the Fiona trial, which was like finerenone versus placebo that is ongoing. And, this is like hold the space here, right? Like ... more to come. That was the gist of the pediatric CKD advanced therapeutic session, which was wonderful and gave us a lot of things to think about for our patients with CKD. Laura, any other thoughts about this topic?
I think it just makes me really like hopeful, right? That there's new therapeutics on the horizon for patients that sometimes you feel like you don't have a lot to offer for, right? And you're just waiting for that decline. So I think seeing that there's these new therapies coming is really, really just encouraging.
Right. Sometimes we just feel like tailors. We are measuring things, we're measuring and saying, oh, here's your estimated GFR. And then we're like, well, doc, how can we preserve this function? And then we talk about all those things like preventing infections and medications and all of those things. But we, to have something to offer to say, this will improve the longevity of your kidney all the way to 120 years, right? So that would be great if we had therapeutics like that. So
I think especially too, right? Because we are dealing with pediatric patients that have they have so much life left, right? Like our patients aren't 50, 60, 70, like they have 70 years of their life left. Like, so we have a lot of work to do to make their kidney last them.
Yes, absolutely. And if their native kidney is no longer functioning and we do transplant, I mean, in their lifetime, these young people have to face at least two transplants and, we should be able to make strides in that field. And I know that there's lots of, the CKD study really gave us so much data and still ongoing data with us. So kudos to those investigators and making sure that we have really good therapeutics to offer children. So this was, this episode was dedicated to advanced therapeutics. And I just give myself props for kind of learning about machine learning and AI, as well as pronouncing a few of the MABs accurately. So I apologize for all the other errors in my pronunciation. But like I said, I'm just being dragged into the 21st century with all these exciting talks and things on the horizon, which is what the ASPN conference is about, really, is, you know, once in a year, we refresh ourselves and learn what's coming. And so clinicians in the field, researchers, we all get new ideas, and that community just drives the field forward, right?
So yeah, it was such a wonderful conference. Yeah.
Did you have a good time in DC?
Yeah, it was such a great conference. I feel like there was just so many people there. It was well represented. It was really nicely laid out. You could make it to the sessions well. It was a very nice conference.
Wonderful. Well, that is the end of this episode, folks. This was episode 2, Advances in Therapeutics for Children with Kidney Diseases. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. And we will be back with episode 3, which is going to be all about IV fluids and more. So we'll get that. All of these episodes will be available to you by mid-May. So if you're listening to it now, it's probably mid-May. And so this is Sudha Garimella signing off for the Sediment.